the difference between a correction. Now, expect a 5 to 10% correction this year before the election. Expect a 5 to 10% correction. Use that as an opportunity to add exposure to portfolio. The difference between a correction and a crash, and can we have a crash? Absolutely, we can have a crash. But this goes back to what we said at the beginning of this conversation, which is we need an unexpected exogenous event that nobody was anticipating that causes the market to immediately reprice expectations of earnings growth going into next year.
Welcome back to Soar Financially, everybody, where we discuss the macro to understand the micro. My name is Kai Hoffman. I'm the @JR Mining Guy on Twitter and the CEO of the Soar Financial Group. Really appreciate you joining us here for a really interesting debate today with Lance Roberts. He's the Chief Investment Officer over at RIA, and he's also the host of The Real Investment Show. Really looking forward to this discussion because I've prepared a flurry of topics. I think I could chat with for a couple hours with Lance and not go through them all. Lots going on, lots to catch up on. One funny one is Taylor Swift saving the U.S. economy? Of course, just an icebreaker there. But we got non-farm payrolls last week. The Fed made their announcement last week as well. If I'm picking up a bit of a momentum and sentiment change maybe in the main markets as well, like the discussion of a no landing scenario, even a bounce back of the U.S. economy is being discussed in the markets these days. So we've got lots to talk about with Lance. But before I switch over to my guest, real quick reminder, I know 80 to 85% of you watching are not subscribed. Let's change that so we can bring guests like Lance Roberts here on this channel. Lance, now it is my huge pleasure to introduce you here. Thanks so much for making the time. It's good to see you.
Absolutely. Glad to be here.
Absolutely. Let's dive right in. Lots to discuss, very little time. Let's start with the state of the economy, Lance. How are we doing? I mentioned earlier, I'm sensing a bit of a sentiment change. I'm curious what your thoughts are.
Yeah, no, it's very interesting. So, let's go back to 2022 for just a second. And, the markets are, the Fed's hiking rates, the markets are coming down. Everybody is expecting a recession in 2022. They're like, oh, we're definitely having a recession. Leading economic indicators are negative, yield curves are negative, and those have a long track record of being perfect predictors of a recession. But a long time ago, I've been in this business for almost 40 years now, and a long time ago, I had an acquaintance with Bob Farrell over at Merrill Lynch who had 10 trading rules to live by. One of them was that when all experts agree, something else tends to happen. And so in 2022, everybody expected this recession. We have this massive bear market. The market bottoms in October, has rallied ever since then. And despite all of these economic indicators, like the yield curve, like leading economic indicators, et cetera, all being negative, so far the economy has avoided a recession. Now the question is why? Well, what people didn't factor in, and we've been talking about this for a little bit over about a year and a half now, actually saying, look, we're not going to have a recession. And the reason is because not only did we do all of this stimulus spending back in 2020 with sending checks to households, that was one little bit of it. But then we did a lot of other things like expand tax credits and extended unemployment benefits. And then we added more incentives into different tax breaks for the economy. That all gave, we had a moratorium on rent and mortgages and student loan payments. That all gave people extra money to spend, and they did their job. They went out and they spent money, and that kept the economy going. But as that money was starting to run out, then we started passing bills in Congress, the Inflation Reduction Act, $1.7 trillion, the CHIPS Act, which a lot of the CHIPS Act money to build semiconductors here in the United States hasn't even hit the economy yet. So there's a lot, there's so much money coming into the economy from all these different sources. And of course, don't forget that at the same time, consumers, which are having a tough time making ends meet, they're turning to credit card debt. And then we invented this whole new form of credit that doesn't show up in the credit card, kind of analysis, which is this buy now, pay later scheme, through companies like Affirm and PayPal, which are giving people just additional sources of revenue to go spend. And so all that's keeping this economy going and a lot stronger than what a lot of people thought was going to happen. And now, interestingly enough, everybody, go back to Bob Farrell's rule, about assessments, everybody now thinks that there's no way we're going to have a recession. We're going to have the soft landing. and it's all going to be great. And look, right now, that's probably the case. So the question that we all need to ask ourselves, though, is what would change that? Right? So right now, the consumer is doing okay. What triggers a recession, ultimately, is something that happens that is totally unexpected and an exogenous event. And right now, the market's pricing in. You know, we can talk about what's happening in Ukraine. We can talk about Israel. We can talk about Yemen and talk about the Houthis. And we can talk about all these different things. But see, the market already knows all that. And, you know, we were talking last week on our radio show, you know, talking about this very same thing, saying, look, you know, when you wake up one morning and the market's down 4 or 5% in the morning, whatever caused that, that's the thing the market didn't expect. That's the thing where everybody will immediately stop spending and you'll have your recession. But right now, we don't have anything like that in the economy. But again, you know, the thing is that if the market knows about it and the economy knows about it, it's already priced in. So what you're looking for is something we wake up tomorrow morning and that nobody was even, it wasn't on anybody's radar. And that's the thing that just makes everybody reassess everything all at one moment. And that's how you get your recession.
No, absolutely. Like, I'm surprised, like, as you mentioned, I think a lot has been priced in, like the Evergrande debacle in China, for example. Mm-hmm. I expected it to make way more headlines. Yep. Looking at $300 billion commercial real estate giant completely falling apart and lots of sovereign debt holders as well, but not even a mention the last few days in the mainstream media about it. Right. So everybody must have priced that in. Like, do you agree?
Yeah, no, absolutely. That's exactly right. You know, anything that takes time to occur, you know, we've been talking about like, for instance, one of the big headline risks right now is commercial real estate in the United States, right? There's all this commercial real estate liability that's sitting on the bank's balance sheets. The market has now already priced all that in. You take a look at regional bank stocks, and look, there's still impacts happening. Look at what's happening with the New York Bank today. You know, that's still occurring, and that risk is still there, but the market has already gone through all of the commercial real estate. We've already worked that out. Same thing with Evergrande. It took a long time for that to mature. The market knew it was coming. The market kind of figured out what was going to happen ahead of time. And the market started pricing that in. And so that's my whole point is that the thing that you and I know, you know, let's sit here for a second and say, okay, what's the worst possible thing that's going to happen in the next 6 months? Whatever we can come up with, if you and I know it, the market knows it, right? Yeah. So that's not going to be the thing. You know, probably a lot of your viewers weren't around in 2008. It's you know, so long ago now. But, you know, I went through 87. I've been through the dot-com crash. I went through the financial crisis. And if you go back, and when I was managing money during the financial crisis, the market was coming down in 2008, but it was a very normal decline. It was just kind of going into a correctionary, kind of like we saw in 2022, just kind of moving down a little bit, nothing dramatic, or, you know, nobody's house was on fire. And then all of a sudden, and I'll remember this for the rest of my life, because I was sitting in an apartment. I'd sold my house and I was sitting in an apartment with my wife and my kids at the time. This is in September. It's a Friday night and we're sitting there and Hurricane Ike is blowing into Houston. You know, there's trees blowing down everywhere, high winds, water's flooding everywhere. And I'm watching the news, and the next morning I wait. And at that moment, Lehman was rated a AA rated bond, trading at near par. I wake up the next morning in the middle of this hurricane in Houston, and Lehman Brothers is forced into bankruptcy. Immediately, everything froze. Banks would not trade with anybody else. Nobody knew what was going to happen. And the market, the 40% of the entire, of the 50% decline occurred after that moment, because the markets couldn't price that in. Nobody knew what tomorrow was going to hold because nobody wanted to trade with anybody. Nobody was willing to take on credit risk, and it just immediately imploded everything. See, that's the risk I'm talking about. That's where we wake up tomorrow morning, and it'll be on a Saturday when you can do absolutely nothing about it, but we'll wake up and there'll be something like that. And generally it's a credit related event, but that's what drives the recession. That's what causes CEOs to start laying off people en masse, and you get your recession and consumers contract because they don't know what's going to happen tomorrow. They're going to have a job. And that's how this all occurs. And right now we just don't have anything like that at the moment.
Yeah, because everything's been forecasted like yesterday. right? Like, let's stay on the topic of commercial real estate. WeWork went bust. Just read this morning that WeWork might actually get bought out of bankruptcy. I listened to an interview of Larry Fink, BlackRock CEO, with Nikolai Tangen over at the Norwich Southern Wealth Fund. He was talking that work from home topic is done with. He fully disagrees with it. First year, great. But everything after that, it wasn't effective at all anymore. So now everybody's coming back to the offices. So is the commercial real estate, I'm mentioning it because it was seen as the trigger for a recession because everybody's got to refinance and with 50%, empty rate, it was the trigger. Let's stay on that topic real quick. Have we solved the commercial real estate crisis? Are we done with that? Or is it still a big, the Damocles sword hanging over us?
Well, I don't know if it's a Damocles sword, but we haven't solved the problem. Just for instance, I do some private real estate investing on my own and as part of this, and I have a group that I work with, and the group that I work with just acquired a building in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. JP Morgan had a loan on this building at $55 million. The building was bought from JP Morgan for $25 million. And so the bank had to write off the difference. But we're seeing, and that's just one example, but there is a lot of that going on. There's a lot of commercial real estate that we built because, you know, I live in Houston, Texas. There's a tremendous amount of just empty office space everywhere in Houston. We were building in the heyday, we were building buildings everywhere. And all of a sudden, you know, we had the shutdown of the economy and nobody was working from offices. And that's still there. And so there's going to be over the next couple of years, we'll work through this process. There's going to be a lot of banks that are going to unload and real estate investors that are going to lose a lot of money over the next few years because they bought wrong and they're going to sell these things at very distressed prices. But in that also is a lot of opportunity, right? So for the person that has capital and has the ability to leverage some of these opportunities, distressed equity is going to be a really good opportunity over the next couple of years because those buildings they're not going to blow the buildings up, right? They're going to repurpose them. But as you said, just like my company, we were working remote for a long time. We've now mandated, hey, come back to the office. You know, we rent all this space. Come back to the office and use it, damn it.
But productivity as well, I think, is a big factor as well. And Larry Fink, I love going back to that interview because I think it was quite insightful. He said, well, if you're young and starting out, and I've referred to that as me doing IR, without a network, I would have been dead in the water during COVID. Yeah. But I started years and years beforehand, so it was all fine. But if you start out new in a new industry, a new job, how are you supposed to build those relationships working from home, just doing mind-numbing tasks doesn't really,
right.
It's not productive.
It's not productive. And, what we learned, so we manage money for a living. This is, kind of what we do. We run portfolios and all that. There's so much organic activity that occurs when you're in the office that, we can all be on a remote and have phone meetings and all this stuff. It's great. But you lose that organic activity that occurs when you're, sitting around for us. We're talking about markets, or we're talking about a stock or a company, and somebody goes, "Hey, I just thought about this. What do you think about that?" And you get these organic debates that start going on that lead to a lot better outcome. And what we learned, particularly from our younger employees, is that they lost a very valuable part of their work experience was that mentorship. Because, when you work inside of an office and, your peers are in your office with you, that's how you learn. I'm super big on mentorship. And I think everybody that's coming up in business and want to succeed in investing or succeed in building a business or whatever, and it is to get a good mentor that's done it, they're successful, and you go work for them for free if you have to, but you want to learn from those people. And we have a lot of young people that work in our business, but they lost so much over that 2-year period that we've now realized that really impaired our business a bit. And, now we're going to have to make up for it as we kind of go forward. But there was a lot of learning that was lost during a very important time of the market cycle. The decline we had in 2022 and the recovery we had in 2023, there were very important events that occurred around that they lost that learning skill from.
Absolutely. Let's go through the narrative a little bit more, like where the market is going potentially as well. Like, where do you see things headed? Because again, lots going on the macro scale. We had the Fed meeting I mentioned last week as well. Let's maybe talk about the rate cut scenarios a little bit. I was just looking at the latest numbers here from the CME Fed Watch tool. What is it? 54%, 25% basis point cut in May. We're pretty much at 80% for you know, staying put in March. Nothing going to happen there. And then it starts from there. But what are your expectations? And how do you interpret what Chairman Powell said there last week as well?
Well, look, there was never, you know, I disagree with Chairman Powell a lot. So, you know, if I was Fed chairman, I would have done things a lot different a long time ago. I would have been hiking rates back in 2014. But, you know, a couple of things that, you know, from the Fed's perspective, right? If they would step out of the political and step out of the banking side of the business for just a moment. And look, remember, the Federal Reserve is not a government entity. It's owned by their member banks, right? So JP Morgan and Bank of America, those are the member banks of the Fed. And so when the Fed is owning all these bonds and their balance sheets, they're paying a dividend to all these banks. So the banks get a lot of revenue that come from the Fed. And so the Fed, so these banks have every incentive to have lower interest rates, and they apply pressure. And so does the political environment applies pressure. We saw that with Trump back in 2018. We saw it with Biden, you know, recently. So there's pressure, you know, on the Fed to cut rates. But if you think about this for a moment, why would I cut rates here? Look, the economy grew at 4.9% in the third quarter, 3.3% in the fourth quarter, is expected to grow around 3% in the first quarter. You've got employment numbers. We'll talk about the underneath of this surface in a second, but employment's coming in at 335,000. Inflation is coming down. The market's doing fantastic. We're approaching 5,000 on the S&P 500. And in general, the economy's firing on all cylinders. So why cut rates here, right? I've got a policy tool that if I get in trouble economically, I can then cut rates. So if I, you know, and this is the whole reason the Fed cuts rates. So the economy falls into a recession, I cut rates to induce spending, reduce interest rates, make things easier. People go out and they create activity, gets the economy out of recession. But if I cut all my rates before I go into recession, I don't have that policy tool. So, you know, from the Fed's perspective, this is actually nirvana. I could just leave rates at 5% and then just wait for a recession to occur and then cut rates back to zero and go from there. But, you know, they're not going to do that. They're going to start cutting rates sooner than later. And I don't think they'll cut rates in March. I think they'll cut rates by May. And the reason they're going to do this is in anticipation of much slower economic growth. And you know, you'd say, well, look, there's no evidence of that right now. Yes, there is no evidence of that right now because we have still a lot of money in the system. But as I said before, all that money that we inject in the economy is going to start running out. M2, which is how we measure monetary supply within the economy as a percentage of GDP, is falling. And it's very elevated and it is falling. We used kind of an analogy before. You know, talking about, you know, if a python swallows a pig, you got that big lump, you know, in the python, and it's got to work its way through the system. Well, we're probably about 3/4 of the process of digesting that pig at the moment inside the python. And so once that's done, then we're going to go back to what economics can actually be generated by the consumer. Because remember, the economy is 70% consumption. That's all you and me going out buying stuff. Well, there's clear evidence that the consumer is running up against kind of the rails here. Savings rates are falling markedly. I track a gauge that measures the difference between what income and savings will pay for versus how much they have to add on debt every year just to make ends meet. And that ramp up is now we're over $5,000 in debt every year just to make ends meet for the average family. So there's a limit that is probably going to show up in the next 8 to 12 months where we see much lower economic growth, and the Fed's going to try to get ahead of that by cutting rates.
No, absolutely. Like, very, very, a lot of interesting points. I wrote down a few, like, scribbles here as well. Bank term funding program comes to it, and the consumer is struggling. I think I want to stay on the consumer for a second. Talk about credit card debt, but also maybe to offset that in the other direction is the average hourly earnings have been rising constantly. We're up 4.5% year over year, theoretically offsetting inflation.
Theoretically. But you got to be careful.
I'm trying to word it cautiously here because it's you know, everybody knows the real inflation rate is not really 3.5%. It's more like 7 to 8%. Everybody knows that. Right.
But in wages, as an example, the reason wages rose in the last report was because the hours worked were cut. And so if I pay you a dollar to work an hour, the way the math works, if you only work 45 minutes, you made more money because you made a dollar for 45 minutes, even though you still made a dollar. Right.
I think it's the lowest since 2010 or so, I read somewhere.
Yeah.
Or 2009, something like that. Yeah.
Yeah. This is the lowest number of hours worked. That's not a sign of a healthy economy, right? When you're working 34.1 hours a week, that's not a good thing. That's actually normally, and again, this goes back to the interesting conversation, which is that's normally what you see during a recession. But, you know, we're seeing a lot of those anomalies. And when you take, so also when you look at wages, you have to look at hourly wages broken down by supervisors versus non-supervisors. So the 20% of your supervisory workers are the ones that are getting raises. The bottom 80% aren't. And so when you see that wage growth, it's kind of like a lot of our other economic indicators. It's in the top 10% of income earners, top 20% of income earners that are getting the benefit. The rest aren't.
Absolutely. No, okay, I appreciate you clarifying that. And since I seemingly have an expert here, I want to talk non-farm payrolls real quick as well, because they increased by about 350,000 in January. Can you break that down for us? Like, personally, I haven't looked in detail at the number, but I remember looking at some of the last numbers. There were a lot of government jobs.
Yeah,
part of that.
We've seen that a lot lately. And so there was a lot of anomalies inside these recent kind of employment reports. They're not nearly as strong as the headline number is. But you know, you also have to remember that the Bureau of Labor Statistics, the way they generate these numbers is they do a survey. Well, they survey large employers because they're easy to get a hold of, and then they extrapolate that across small and medium-sized businesses, which are 50% of your employment. So small to mid-sized businesses make up 50% of the employment in the U.S. So they're very important. They're not hiring a whole bunch of people. and you know, it's interesting because I've seen a lot of you know, videos lately and you know, things like on LinkedIn and other social media platforms where millennials, you know, young millennials, young Gen Xers, they're going out and they're sending out resumes on LinkedIn. And of course, you look at the job opening labor turnover survey, you know, apparently we have jobs everywhere. And they're like, I've sent out 1,400 resumes. I've gotten no callbacks, right? Nobody's hiring. And that's a very common sentiment that we're seeing really across the board. And that's particularly in these smaller to mid-sized companies that they've got their staff. They're not laying off right now because good employees are hard to come by. So if you've got good employees, you hang on to them for dear life, but they're not hiring other people. So when we start digging down to these numbers, we start finding some anomalies. So there's two surveys. There's the Bureau of Labor Statistics. That's the main one. That's the one everybody pays attention to. But that data is derived from the household survey. And the household survey is the actual survey of households. Hey, are you working or are you not working? That number's actually been declining. There is about a 2 million person gap between what the Bureau of Labor Statistics says is people working versus the household survey. And that gap's one of the largest we've had on record. Dig down further into that, then of course you see that most of the jobs have been part-time jobs versus full-time employment. And that's crucially important because full-time jobs are what support a family. So if you've got your wife, one or two children, you've got your house, you know, or your apartment, whatever, you need a full-time job to cover the rent, utilities, the health care, because you need your benefits from the company, et cetera. So full-time employment's very important versus part-time. And full-time employment has actually dropped off very sharply over the last 4 months. And normally when you see full-time employment drop sharply as a percentage of the working age population, that has been a predecessor to an economic recession. Now, it's interesting, in this last report, we saw full-time employment tick up just mildly. But the only reason that full-time employment picked up as a percentage of the population is because we reduce the population by 625,000 people in an adjustment. So we just said, oh, there's not as many people in the population we thought. So it made the full-time employment look better, only because it's kind of like the wages, cut the number of hours, wages look better, cut the number of people, employment looks better. That doesn't help the average American. And that's not what the, and this is why people are so frustrated, because what they hear in the media, they're like, you know, I've been out of work for 6 months, can't get a job. And they're telling me everybody's doing great. You know, it's, that's why you get this dissension.
Yeah. Well, you brought up the household survey, and as part of the unemployment rate, I was doing some research on it, and the Congressional Budget Office changed some of the projections for U.S. population that is going into the household survey. So net immigration is actually projected to be higher now, and it factors into the unemployment rate as well. Right. So they're throwing net immigration in there as well. It seems like they're trying to cheat the numbers a little bit in that regard. Like, and I'm choosing my words carefully because net immigration is a very politicized topic right now. But how does that factor in, Lance? I think we need to talk about that.
No, absolutely. You know, it's a huge factor, and I wish more people really understood. You know, from the political side, right? We all have our feelings, right? I think you know, everybody needs an opportunity to come to the United States, and you know, we want all these people here, and that's fine. There's nothing wrong with that. There is another side to this story, which is there's a detrimental side to kind of uncontrolled immigration. And look, I live in Texas. I live in Houston, Texas. So I'm right in the middle of this whole immigration wave we're having into the state of Texas, and this whole battle now between the government and Texas over the border. Because we just had this massive push of immigration into the state of Texas over the, and we're talking over, you know, a couple of million people into Texas over the last several years, that they need jobs, right? They need a job. They need a place to live. They've got to exist. That's why they're here. And that's good. And as a humanitarian, I'm like, look, come to America. This is a land of opportunity. We love to have you. And as a humanitarian, we should do that. But it needs to be done in an orderly process, because the other side of this story is when you get this overwhelming surge of immigration, it displaces other workers. And in this case, it displaces native-born workers, which, and if you take a look at the recent payroll stats and recent employment stats, the number of jobs going to foreign-born workers are outpacing the number of jobs to native-born. You take a look at one of the most important, you know, economic phases of an individual's life, and that's between the age of 16 and 20. And that's normally where we're getting our first jobs. And I don't know about you, but I'm an old guy. I grew up in the 70s. And, you know, when I was 13, I was a short order cook inside of a country club, you know, cooking, you know, frying hamburgers in the back. But my first, you know, kind of real job, and I think everybody else is in the world, you work fast food, you wait tables, you do that type of thing. You know, you're working at the McDonald's drive-thru or whatever it is. And that's your great first experience into the job. And look, there are minimum wage jobs. They're meant to be minimum wage because you don't know anything. You're there to learn a skill, learn how to deal with, you know, a supervisory chain of organization, learn how to take orders, direction, and you're there to mess up, right? And you're going to get fired. Everybody gets fired from their first job. But that's how you learn, right? And that prepares you to go out. And because of this immigration, we displaced a lot of those 16 to 20 year old workers that should have been getting those jobs with people that were willing to work for, you know, more hours and less pay. And we've done a disservice to our youth growing up. And that's just, and again, that's not, you know, I'm not saying that we shouldn't have immigration at all, because we've got a demographic problem in the U.S. that China's dealing with now. We're not producing enough children. If you want to have a strong economy, you've got to have population growth. So if you're not generating natural born population, you've got to immigrate. But this is where you go to a merit-based immigration system. You go through a legal immigration system to import the type of workers that you need to grow your economy, make it stronger, more prosperous for everyone. But, you know, this is a whole nother thing we can get into. But, you know, immigration is incredibly important. You've got to have it to make the economy grow, but it also has to be done in an orderly manner.
No, absolutely. I appreciate you sharing your thoughts there. And one topic I wrote down as well, and maybe we can jump down that rabbit hole for just a second, at least, sure. Is automation and productivity. Yep. You brought up McDonald's. I thought of the machines they got at McDonald's now where you can order, maybe pretty much cutting at least 2-3 staff members from the workforce.
But even with that, their ice cream machine still doesn't work.
It still doesn't work. Right. But I want to talk about that. Maybe also we could touch on AI as part of that discussion, yeah, as well, because we talked about the 34 and a half hour work week here as well. Like productivity, automation, AI is maybe a big, big topic we need to tackle here as well. Mm-hmm. How does that all fit together? Because as you said, like, we're eliminating part of the workforce. We're trying to increase productivity based on the job, the average hour earnings increase. We are increasing productivity, but is that the right way? And with people praising AI on Bloomberg as the Hail Mary and the savior of our economy, is that the way to go, or are we just fooling ourselves?
I think you're fooling yourself. Look, when I was growing up, my father worked for Dow Chemical Company, and you know, back then, this was when computers were just coming around, right? So we had the Commodore 64 and the Atari and the Tandy 1000. From Radio Shack. Those were the computers back then. And, you know, my dad made the statement back then. He said, look, he says, you know, this is great because it's going to make people so much more productive. Also, that was where Federal Express was first getting started. And nobody thought, everybody was sitting around going, who needs a package overnight? Just mail it. I'll take it in 5 days, right? But those were all changes. And then, of course, the advent of the internet, et cetera, changed the way we work. It made us so much more, and made us so much more productive. That was fantastic. But take a look at what you and I are doing right now. We're producing a video, right? That hopefully thousands of people are going to see. You're on your side by yourself. I'm on my side by myself. Now, to do this back in the early 80s would require a television station, a whole staff of people, cameras, producers, all kinds of stuff to generate exactly what we're doing for basically no cost between the two of us right now, other than our internet costs and the cost of the computer, et cetera. And we're going to go and you're going to go publish this on your YouTube channel, and people are going to see this. And it's a fantastic thing. But how many jobs did we eliminate because of that? Another good example, you know, technology is awesome. When I was growing up, if you called a company, there was a receptionist that answered the phone, says, yes, sir. What can I do? How can I direct your phone call? Yes, let me get Mr. Peabody on the phone, or whoever it was. And that was a job. And that job has been displaced. When was the last time that you called a company and somebody actually picked up the phone and you didn't get an answering service that press 1 for English, press 2 for Spanish? Now, here's this whole list of options you got to go through to try to eventually get to somebody who might actually even talk to you anymore. But that was a whole level of jobs that we displaced. Those people didn't come back. Now, the theory is, right, is that we would displace the receptionist. He or she would go back to college, get a degree to come back to do something else, right? So they'll get a computer program. That's not the way the world really works. A lot of these people get displaced and they never grow out of that, right? They stay in that kind of very difficult space to get a work. So in general, people don't go back to school to get further education. Now, some do, and I'm not saying this is a blanket statement, but this is why we keep seeing this bigger and bigger gap between the top 10 and 20% of income earners and everybody else in the economy. If everybody else in the economy was getting reeducated, you'd have a lot more people earning more money doing more jobs. So the problem with AI is, and again, it's a fantastic thing, and I've been watching all of the Terminator series just to be ready for what comes next. That's a joke. this is going to, you know, the difference with AI is that, yeah, so take McDonald's as an example. In California, the state of California raised the minimum wage to like $25 an hour. I can't remember what the number was. So the first thing McDonald's did is says, fine, we'll completely automate our franchise. And so they built a completely automated McDonald's. And that displaced those workers that were supposed to get a minimum wage. So they didn't get a minimum wage hike. They lost their job. Now, the problem with AI is that, yes, we can do with robots right now, we can displace a lot of manual labor. So, you know, a lot of manufacturing jobs. A good example of this was Carrier Industries. If you remember back during the Trump, when President Trump was elected, You know, he was like, make America great, bring companies back. And one of the first companies that came back was Carrier Industries. And everybody held, oh, look, Carrier Industries is moving their plant from Mexico back to the United States. Well, Jim Cramer did an interview with Greg Hayes at the time, who was the CEO of Carrier Industries. He says, this is great, you're doing it back. And he says, look, we have to. He says, when government is doing something, our parent company is United Technologies. It's now Raytheon Technologies. So we've got massive contracts with United Technologies with the government. We don't want to upset the government. So yeah, we're going to sacrifice this plant and we're going to move it to Indiana. But as soon as we do that, we're going to automate almost the entire plant. We're getting all kinds of tax breaks from Indiana to do this. But at the end of the day, we're going to cut jobs by probably 40 to 50%. By moving that plant. And so the question came up, it's like, well, why do you have the plant in Mexico to start with? He says, look, these people show up to work. They don't demand a lot. They work 7 days a week. They don't ask for time off. We pay them very little money to do their job and they're completely happy with it. When I move that plant here, I've got to pay benefits and 401k plans and healthcare costs and higher wages and all that to get Americans to work. And so this is, so when you start bringing AI in, the difference with AI is that it replaces high paying jobs. AI will replace jobs for lawyers, for doctors, for, you know, computer programmers, because AI can program a computer. So all these jobs that you thought you were protected in is like, oh, well, you know, they can't replace me with a robot. AI can replace you. AI is going to replace me at some point down the road.
No, absolutely. It's like a big topic. We can, you know, spend hours on discussing as well. But I want to wrap that up because I have two more topics I want to touch on. One is the bond market. We need to talk about it. Yeah. I mentioned to you before recording, it's a big bond week here in the U.S. About $121 billion of bonds will be sold this week by the U.S. Treasury. $54 billion of three-year Treasury notes actually today as we're recording this February 6th. $42 billion tomorrow in 10-year notes and $25 billion 30-year bonds. We need to discuss the bond market because we're still at a fairly high yield level. Where do you see things going? Because with the announcement of the bond, or not the announcement, but what do you call it? It's like the start of the bond auctions, maybe. The yields jumped a little bit this morning. Yeah. Where do you see things headed for the bond market?
Well, so first of all, you know, don't get too wrapped up in the bond auctions. They are one-day events. And you know, all the bond auctions are in most cases is that, you know, we're going to do it sounds huge. We're going to have a $20 billion bond offering. Most of that's just replacing bonds that have matured. So, you know, companies that have debt on their books, they have a 10-year treasury that matures. And so that's got to get paid off. And then they buy the new treasury and replace that position. So a lot of it's just replacing bonds that are rolling off. We're not issuing all that much new debt. So that's important. Don't get too wrapped up in the very short-term thing with yields. There's a lot of volatility that goes on with yields short-term driven by headlines. It's like, oh my gosh, CPI was stronger than expected, so we're going to push yields up. CPI was weaker than expected, so we're going to push yields down. That's just the bond market kind of doing their thing, because remember what yields are is a representation of what I see risk as in the future. So as a bond owner, right? If I'm going to buy a bond, so I'm going to buy a bond, I've got to factor in. So great, I'm going to give you $1,000. You're going to give me an IOU, which is all a bond is, that says you're going to pay me 5% over the next 10 years. Well, that 5% has to account for economic growth, opportunity cost, inflation cost, credit risk. Are you a good credit or not? I mean, are you going to pay me back for sure? You know, that's got to be aware of that. It's got to factor in all of these things. Cause I got to say, well, if I take 5% or 4% or 3%, whatever the number is, what if I invested that money in something else? I could get a higher yield. So that opportunity cost is a big driver of that relative. And that opportunity is driven by inflation and economic growth expectations. So there is a very, very high correlation between the yield on 10-year treasuries long-term, not this week and not next week, but over years, a very high correlation between interest rates, inflation, and economic growth. economic growth is going to return to 2% because of the how much debt we have outstanding. The more debt you have, the slower economic growth you have, the more debt you have outstanding, the more you divert a productive income into debt service, which lowers the economic living standard of 80% of the economy. As a function of that, as they spend less and economic growth slows, inflation comes down because inflation is strictly a function of supply and demand, goods versus services. So inflation falls. And as inflation falls and economic growth slows towards 2%, which is where we'll wind up, maybe less, it'll probably be like 1.7, 1.6. That's where the 10-year yield will wind up as well, because interest rates will reflect what's happening in both economic growth and inflation over the long term. Now, that doesn't mean next week, next month, 6 months from now, but over the next 2 to 3 years, and the yield on the 10-year treasury will be lower than where it is today. So just your convexity of your bonds suggests if you buy bonds today, your upside is probably going to outpace the stock market over the next 2 years.
Lance, I want to talk investment strategy with you sort of as a final topic, and talk about what would you invest and would you buy bonds right now at 4.5%, for example, or at over 5% for a 6 month? We'll talk about that in a second, because I saw one interesting statement this morning as well, and it's a great time to be in fixed income right now, corporate bonds, because there's low recession risk, low default risk, and higher returns possible right now ahead of potential rate cuts. Would you agree with that statement?
Yeah, but with corporate bonds, you introduce a whole issue of credit risk. And so as with anything, when you start buying a corporate bond, you've got to understand the company that you're investing in. And this is really where you've got to do your fundamental research. And look, when you buy a stock, you're just betting on the price going up. You know, it's just buyers versus sellers. Is the price going up or not? When you own debt, right, that is all a fundamental question. Can the company pay me back? And there are a lot of companies, when we have a recession and there's a huge debt wall coming in corporates beginning in 2024, that if rates aren't much lower from there, in other words, we haven't cut rates significantly, there's about 20% of the Russell 2000 that's at risk of defaulting on their debt. So I'm not saying you shouldn't own corporate debt, because corporate debt is a good opportunity, but you don't get paid for it. Right now, if you buy a corporate bond, you get 5%. I'm just throwing out a couple of numbers, but you buy a corporate bond at 5 with a risk of default. I can buy a U.S. Treasury at 4.5. Again, just making numbers, with no risk of default. So take the 4.5 and get rid of the default risk. You're not getting the spread between corporates and treasuries does not justify the risk premium you take on for buying a corporate, not right now, and particularly in high yield as well. You don't get paid for that risk either. So, you know, if there's a recession, that's where you run the risk of really losing a lot of money. A lot of people buy high yield just to track the index. They're like, oh, this is just a proxy for the S&P 500. Nothing wrong with that, but just understand the risk you're taking.
Absolutely. No, I appreciate that. Like, if you believe in the U.S. economy and trampoline moments, then maybe that's the way to go. But personally, I don't believe in it. Like, I have a hard time seeing it. I'm not sure why sentiment is changing in mainstream media right now, but people are changing their calls from ultra bearish to, oh, maybe I was wrong. Maybe we are in a very strong economy. Personally, I don't believe that. So one last topic before we come to investment strategies. I really want to talk quickly about the main markets, S&P 500, because we've discussed it a number of times here on the channel. Is like, are we in a melt-up rally right now, Lance? Like, S&P 500 is touching on 5,000 points, which is insane, because we were roughly at 40-50 just at the end of October last year. So roughly that's a 25% move in 3.5 months. That's a crazy rally. Are we losing steam? What's happening after we reach 5,000?
Well, so I just did a chart on this just recently. I wrote an article on our website at realinvestmentadvice.com talking about S&P 5,000. And I did a chart of how long it takes to get to these $1,000 increments. So to go from, S&P 50 to S&P 1,000, 1,000, 2,000, 2,000, 3,000. It took almost 9,000 days to get to the first 1,000. Then it took about 4,000 days to get to the second 1,000. Now we're doing this in very rapid increments as we go up. What has happened historically is that every time you hit these $1,000, these psychological boundaries of these nice round numbers, 1,000, 2,000, 3,000, the market tends to correct, because the markets are getting very ahead of themselves. We're getting super bullish right now. You take a look at retail and professional sentiment versus bullish versus bearish. We're at one of the highest levels on record. So everybody, and again, not surprising that all the bears are now bulls, because that's what you want to see kind of at the peak of a market, is you drag everybody into the pool, and then that's when the tide goes out. So, you know, we're going to have a correction this year, I would say sometime between this month and probably March, April, May, before we get to the election. We're going to have a 5-10% correction. That'll be after we hit 5,000 on the S&P, though.
Absolutely. Okay. So, but that's not a massive correction. Like I wrote down somewhere, correction versus crash scenarios. What's the difference, right? So a 10% correction might feel like a crash to many, but that's only 500 points. That brings us pretty much back to, I don't know, like I'm exaggerating to where we're at right now, right?
But you think, but remember last July, right? In July of last year, everybody's like, this rally is just not going to stop. I mean, this market, everybody was bullish, right? Market is going to the moon. Look at this. It's all AI. And then I was writing an article in June and July saying, be aware, we're about to have the 5-10% correction, completely normal in any bull market. And then between August, September, October, we had a 10% correction. By the time we got to October, sentiment was super bearish. Everybody was convinced that the selling was never going to stop and we were never going up again. I wrote an article about, hey, we're about to have a rally after October weakness. We're going to have a rally into the end of the year because of these factors. And everybody's like, you're crazy. This market's going down. It's all complete bullshit. And then we had this rally, right? So, but that's just the way markets work. Now, the difference between a correction. Now, expect a 5-10% correction this year before the election. Expect a 5-10% correction. Use that as an opportunity to add exposure to portfolio. The difference between a correction and a crash, and can we have a crash? Absolutely, we can have a crash. But this goes back to what we said at the beginning of this conversation, which is we need an unexpected exogenous event that nobody was anticipating that causes the market to immediately reprice expectations of earnings growth going into next year.
If you were a betting man, Lance, what would you bet on the black swan to be? Like if you had like some random guess, I know like if we know about it, the market knows about it. Yeah. But if there's something you would bet on, like just, you know, anything.
In order for it to be an issue, it's not going to be a war issue unless somebody dropped it. You know, if there was a terrorist attack, you know, in a major city, like I'm talking like another 9/11 type situation, or somebody nuked Chicago or something. I mean, that's that type of war scenario, that's not good for markets. The most realistic possibility, it's got to be something credit related. So it would be a rash of banks, of regional banks defaulting. That would be something, and it would have to happen very quickly. It couldn't be one bank and then 4 months, another bank, right? Because we price that in. But I'm talking about we wake up tomorrow morning and it's not just New York, you know, Credit Bank, it's PNC. I'm not saying anything wrong with these banks, so don't go freak out. Just, and examples, right? But all of a sudden tomorrow morning, PNC, Truist, Commonwealth, and these banks are all getting shuttered by the FDIC. That would cause the market to reprice things. A credit risk. And how do you know if something's coming? All you got to do is watch credit spreads. If you want to know if there's a risk in the market, if somebody tells you, you know, watch out because this market's about to fall off the precipice because of ABC. Go look at the credit spreads between triple B rated bonds and the AAA rated treasury. If there is no spread, in other words, they haven't done this, there's no risk because the credit market will price that in immediately. So when you see credit default credit spreads jump, that's when you know there's a problem.
Fantastic. No, that's a good explanation. And maybe a question to put a bow around all of our discussion here is where do you feel comfortable investing right now? That brings me a bit to the investment strategy as well. If you had somebody, if I were sitting in front of you right now in your office and said, hey, Lance, I got $100,000 to invest, where would you put my money?
In cash for the moment. And here's why. Here's the only reason why. So we run a variety of portfolios. In fact, we just launched a new dividend equity model. But our portfolios are fully allocated at this moment. So like our 60-40 model, 60% stocks, 40% bonds. We own Google, NVIDIA. We own Apple, Microsoft, Eli Lilly, ExxonMobil, Walmart, Costco, AbbVie. I mean, we own the big names, right? But the problem is the market is has advanced so far so quickly this year. We're so overbought that if you gave me money today, I'd just sit in cash for right now because we're going to get a correction. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5% somewhere along the way, we're going to get a correction. And I would rather invest your money at that point because at that point, the risk reward is better. And here's kind of an interesting thing about this. Let's just say the market's trading at 5,000. So we just have an easy number to work off of. The market goes to 6,000 and then comes back to 5,000. And you go, and that's where you invest. That's okay because after that market corrects from 6,000 back to 5,000, the risk reward of making money at that point is better than where it was before it went to 6,000 first, right? So what this is the question people always ask me is, well, and I get this from when we have prospective clients come in, it's like, well, are you going to invest me today? No, not right now, but we'll opportunistically look to buy things. So, and again, you know, we own a basket of stocks and bonds. So if a stock falls out of bed, we may buy that one for you, but nothing else. And so we'll use opportunities in the market. But look, keep this real simple. Investing is about opportunity. And so if I'm going to be investing in the market, I want to buy things that are undervalued, they're cheap relative to the rest of the market. And that's how I'm going to make money. If I buy everything that's overvalued, I'm going to wind up losing money because eventually valuations will revert to fair value at some point. And so if I overpay for, and this makes sense of anything in life, you know, as always find it very interesting. I'll wrap up on this point. People go online and they want to buy a new hairdryer, right? They'll shop 50 different places to find the best deal on a hairdryer, but they'll go buy, you know, NVIDIA stock at 45 times price to sales or whatever. You know, apply the same logic that you do with your money on everything else you spend. You wouldn't overpay for a house. You wouldn't pay $50,000 for a $30,000 car. But that's what you do with stocks all day long because we're all in this FOMO of, oh, the market's going to go up. But if you invest prudently and take your time, be patient, look for opportunity, you're going to make way more money over time. It's not as fun. It's not as fun, but you'll make way more money.
If I would have researched some of the mining stocks I invested in, like I've researched some fantasy football players.
Yeah, you'd be a lot better.
I would have been a wealthy man, I'll tell you that.
Exactly.
Lance, very last question. Who's winning the Super Bowl?
I think the Chiefs.
Chiefs, perfect.
I think so. I don't have a dog in the hunt, right? I'm from Houston, so Texans aren't playing. And I did hear a rumor, though, that they were going to start having every Super Bowl in Dallas. That way nobody would ever have a home field advantage again. So.
I like that jab there.
Yeah, I don't have a dog in the hunt. So, no. You know. I'll pick the Chiefs.
Awesome. Lance, I love this conversation. This is the first conversation I probably have done on this channel where we didn't talk about gold. So at least I got to see three more times to get the search engine optimization going here as well. But Lance, where can we find more of your work? Where can we follow you?
Look, we produce a ton of free information at realinvestmentadvice.com. We've got a daily YouTube channel that we run because we do a radio show in Houston. We talk all about money, but we have a weekly newsletter. We have a daily market commentary that talks specifically about what the markets are doing, levels, those type of things. We write blogs 3 times a week. Tons of free information there to help you be a better investor.
Fantastic. By the way, I was really impressed with your studio. I had to pause the video a few times and check out what kind of equipment you were using. So
yeah.
Impressive setup. Lance, thank you so much for your time. I really, really appreciate it. Love the conversation. Make sure to follow Lance. He puts out fantastic content. And make sure to follow us as well. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I have. Make sure to hit that like and subscribe button down below. Leave a comment, especially that like button tells us whether we have the right guests on the program, whether we're discussing the right topics for you. Let us know. It really helps us, A, select guests, but also bring guests like Lance back on the program. Thank you so much for your time. Thank you so much for tuning in. We'll be back with lots more here on this channel. Thank you so much.